John's widow recently sent me a box of John's old stuff, which finally cleared that whole story up for me.
Mm.
And John had a patent notebook entry in December of our first year, maybe December of 59. No, 57,
mm-hmm.
in which he thought about the planar process. But we were all involved in making the first transistor.
Sure.
And the MESA was the certain thing we were going to use, and there was a big discussion. It was going to be an NPN device or a PNP.
Mm-hmm.
And so, again, I have a memo that Gordon was sort of running what might be called the engineering group at that time, and said, we have to make a decision on this. And I have this memo that was very carefully thought out about, you may have seen it.
No, I haven't.
But it was to say, well, through tests, we'll try to make them on what would be a production basis, make NPN ones and make PNP ones. And, not pushing one over the other, just try them and make some and see what happens.
Mm-hmm.
And we did that, and John chose to look at this as more of a personal contest.
Mm-hmm.
Than
a between business, the two of them.
And a business decision. And,
right.
And the upshot was we couldn't make the PNP because we couldn't figure out how to make a good contact to it right
mm-hmm.
away. And some, a number of other reasons, the NPN won out, so we made it. But Gordon ran that and did it in a very pleasant way and didn't push, let the facts speak for themselves.
Right. Not to keep harping on the planar process question, but so he had kind of had those initial ideas then really got into the boron diffusion.
Boron diffusion, which was going to be essential for this. And boron was really, a tough, it exploded. And the only way that you could find the parameters where it was going to explode was to push up there until it did. And I can still see John's furnace where he was doing this, and it faced a concrete wall, and this when it exploded, this tube would go right out and sail into the concrete, and it was dug in about like 3 or 4 inches by the time he was done. But so boron made the quartz get mushy.
Uh-huh.
It was just terrible problems. But John stuck to it. So the I have it written out here, the timing. This was January of, it would be 59. It was a year after this.
Mm-hmm.
And John had worked on a number of other things and went back to this and wrote out a patent disclosure based on his ideas from 12 or 14 months earlier.
Mm.
And I have a copy of that patent disclosure. And with the appropriate notebook entries that went
wow.
on. This was writing it up, you know, to submit to a patent lawyer.
Right.
Which he showed to Noyce. And a week later, Noyce was thinking about this and then wrote his famous patent notebook on how you make an integrated circuit.
That quickly.
What?
It was that, those, I guess I hadn't realized they were that closely connected in time.
Yeah.
Hmm.
And this was before John had made the first planar device, which he needed an extra mask, and I figured out how to jury rig the step and repeat cameras to make the additional mask for.
Mm-hmm.
And, but, Probably would help it, like.
Sure.
Look at this.
Let me pause this. Let's just switch this back on.
Tell me the
UPS. Sure, I'm sorry.
Okay.
Yeah, so this is, so he wrote up his patent disclosure on the 14th of January, 1959.
Yes, based on his ideas of December 57.
Right.
And this was January 14th of 59, and he wrote it, and then set out to build it.
Right.
And on January 20th, John had another idea for control of lifetimes.
Oh.
And that one was witnessed by Noyce on January 20th. So I would guess that John showed these two things to Noyce probably January 20th.
Right.
And Noyce's notebook entry, which was his only thing he ever wrote on integrated circuits, was January 23rd.
Wow, so it's 3 days.
Perhaps. So he sat and he just wrote these ideas down. And he had the, Noyce had the ideas for interconnecting devices this way.
Mm-hmm.
But an equally key thing was how do you isolate the devices one from the other. And he didn't get into that. This was just a general discussion.
Mm-hmm.
But it happened real fast. And then John set out to build it, and that date, I can't remember it exactly, but I can document it exactly. It was the week after Ed Baldwin left, so that'd be March.
Mm.
And Ed left taking what was very quickly an obsolete technology. If he stuck around one more week and seen the kind of device, it's just one of those, just the way Ed did stuff, but so it happened real fast, and then we very rapidly saw the potential of this device. This was January 59, and by the next year had it introduced it at the trade shows.
Introduced
the planar device.
The planar device.
That was
the
picture I showed you that only a mother could love.
Oh, right.
That was March of 50. That'd be March of 59.
Right.
So, the whole progression now is clear. I had written about this in the past, and I told Christoph a lot of this stuff, and I was convinced that John did all this himself, and Noyce's was an independent. It just happened.
Mm.
To both be thinking along these same lines, but I think this is cause and effect here very
clearly. I see, yeah.
And John, and Noyce realized the potential of this right away.
Mm. That makes a lot of sense.
A lot of sense, yeah. But this is all documented now, thanks to John's widow sending me this box of stuff.
Yeah, that's great. And you have that here?
Yes, I have that.
Wow, that's great.
But one problem in all of this was that all the stuff was pretty well documented in our patent notebooks, which were the property of National. The guy running that wouldn't let anybody look at them. So that stopped all the research in this dead.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Yeah.
He would let anybody look at their own, but not somebody else's. So he made me a copy of my patent notebook. But I couldn't look at John's or Noyce's. And,
oh, really?
But I finally gotten them by now. But this was a couple of years. It was frustrating to Christoph, who still isn't to this date not seen John's notebook. I'm going to send it to him now that he's back from France.
Oh, well, that would be great. I know he'd appreciate that greatly.
Yeah, but it all moved along. And the patent, at that time, we were having these terrible problems with metallic particles bouncing around inside the can.
Oh, right.
Out the tap test, if you call it. It was a terrible problem. It could have. We were selling these devices based on reliability, and here there was this catastrophic failure that was taking place. So the planar device was quickly seen that they would solve that problem.
Mm-hmm. Could we go to the of getting that first contract from IBM for these, I guess they were the NPN transistors.
Mm-hmm.
How did that contract come about, and was the end use for these airborne computers?
Airborne computers, yeah. And this would be the transistor was used to get information in and out of the cores,
okay.
Core driver, mm-hmm. which is a little higher power than if it was just used as a memory on-off switch or something.
Right.
Like that. And it was a larger device, and it was in our capability. I look now, we were working with tolerances of a thousandth of an inch, which now is 50 devices in that thousandth. But that was still pretty tough tolerances to be working on a production basis.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know, this was probably drainage and noise that were whacking away. As I said, noise was spending more and more of his time in this external sales thing. And Christoph came up with the story that he'd seen someplace that Sherman Fairchild got involved with talking to the IBM people and telling them it would be a very good idea if they took us seriously, even though we were a small company. It was one he was personally involved with.
Right.
So he put his, added some degree of credence to our ability to make these things.
And you really did have quite a great amount of responsibility in fulfilling this contract.
Yeah.
Isn't that right? I mean, everything from you had responsibility for a big part of the production process, did you not, from like the Mesa etch?
The Mesa etch. And
through the assembly and the...
And some of the assembly. Although, with assembly, they quickly get, you know, people from Kleiner or Julie to help with all this stuff. But and the more engineering people would get directly involved. I was involved in all of these things, but that made the first one in a number of cases.
Mm-hmm.
It was such a group effort. It's just amazing looking back at how everybody was working with everybody else. If something needed to be done, it got done. And obviously if somebody was a laggard in his part of it, the thing wasn't going to get finished. But as I said, when you look through these weekly meetings, how fast this happened. Because every week it was something new happening, and we're having the first devices out in 3 or 4 months from the time we... I mean, things like getting power in the plant were this slow thing. And I sort of laid out the floor plan, which was Sheldon's area, and which was John's area, and I have some pictures of what this plant looked like when it was just started. I just wish I'd taken more pictures, but I had one just when we first put the diffusion elements in.
Oh, I'd love to see
it. Those things are all available. And as I said, I've got this week-by-week account of the progress we made, and you can see how this happened
so rapidly.
And as you look back on it now, relatively smoothly, but it wasn't smooth at the
time. Yeah, I'm sure not. Was that the main coordination medium, that monthly, or weekly meeting, rather?
Mm-hmm.
And that was on Monday morning?
Yeah, Monday mornings, I think we had this meeting. Ran across the guy that was our first accountant he reported to Gene Kleiner at Kleiner's memorial service.
Mm.
He said that was the thing that really flabbergasted me about that group. There was no organized leader, and you all got together on Monday mornings and figured out all this stuff out and went off and did it. He said that he just never saw anything like it before or since.
Huh. When did the need to get some more structure, get Ed Baldwin in there? How did that transpire?
We started seeing it. We had a company. We were going to be hiring marketing people and all the stuff, so we needed a guy to run it. And Noyce, I think, said he didn't feel up to it or didn't want to take on that role.
Mm-hmm.
And so we set out to get our
hire a boss. Went looked at a guy from there. That's an interesting experience. Hire somebody that's very senior in age and everything else to you to be your boss. And talked to some people from Barry and ran across Ed, I think, through an ad in the Wall Street Journal. And he had just what we needed.
And he had come from Hughes, right?
Yeah, which was one of these companies that always had great ideas but never turned it into much of a large-scale production for the most part.
And just to stay with Baldwin coming on board, did that change the the working relationship between the eight founders?
Yeah. Our staff meetings became less. By then, we'd made the first device.
Mm.
And so that spirit of everybody just digging in had disappeared. And you have to have a more formal organization to start manufacturing
right.
these things. And Ed made some very valuable discussions about. I have a. Find it. Meeting with Ed Baldwin, where you can see that he outlined the whole structure of a company and all of the functions that were involved.
Right.
A lot of which has never occurred to me. A formal quality of control. And Ed struck, emphasized from the start, the only way you can make a success of this is you have a very reliable product. And when it goes out the door, it has to really work.
Right.
So that was. I look back on our backgrounds, and knew none of us had ever dreamed of doing something like this. But Ed got in there, and he very quickly went to the Fairchild management, said, "You have to build another plant for this stuff. Damn fast."
Oh, really?
We hadn't even made or shipped or anything. And Ed was talking about the big plant we had to build.
Now, what was his thinking there for the big plant? Just that
this thing was going to explode.
Okay.
It was a device
really
the world
saw.
Needed. And
yeah.
and our limitation, he was absolutely right, our limitation was going to be our ability to manufacture these in the quantities. So we grew into a big company real fast. But you can see on here just times and
goals,
decades and names, and so these are just full of that.
It's a great resource,
yeah, kind of a thing. But so this would be February of 58. Wasn't that far along?
No,
we were talking about another plant, and then we had the first devices coming out. Shortly after that.
We've talked about maybe we could stay with Baldwin for a moment and thinking forward. How long was he there? 2 or 3 years before he...
No,
less than that, right?
No, he left in 59. That was just...
For Ream.
That was just a week before...
The planar process.
Yeah. Which is, I think, about March. March of that data we can nail down to the
right
to the day.
Well, what was your reaction to that development, to that departure?
I was sort of shocked, and a number of people went with him. The people that had come from Hughes that he'd hired, and they all left. And I thought, pretty strange thing to do. I mean, here he's sitting. With a pretty sure, we cut him in as an equal partner with us and all these things, but I don't think he ever felt that comfortable in that role.
Why do you think that was?
Well, we had such a strong group attachment and identity to each other.
Right.
And coming in, and he wasn't, we had done it, and he wasn't our boss in that sense, and he wasn't a full boss with the power to hire and fire us.
Right.
So we owned the company as much as he did.
And Ream had it was soon bought out, it didn't have a very easy time, did it?
Yeah. And Ed, later on, I was visiting him. Raytheon bought it, I suppose.
Okay, that's right.
And I forget what the occasion was, but I went over to his place. We were going to have dinner together, and this was quite a while after that. And he showed me that. He said, "Jay, this is what my life has turned to." It was a big shelf of Raytheon standard practices. And then he said at that time, he said, "You know, that was the stupidest thing I ever did in my life, was to leave." Because I wanted the whole pie and running it all myself. And he said it wasn't very smart. Because, you know, we weren't terribly... you have this recorder on?
It is indeed, yeah.
It's hard to explain now that with the way that venture capital is taken, but making a lot of money out of this was not uppermost in our thoughts. And people don't believe that, but it was true. And I had letters that I wrote saying that we wanted to work together and make a transistor, and we knew how to do it.
Mm.
And I remember Sheldon being pessimistic. Said, "Well, we're not going to ever make a lot of money out of this, but maybe I'll make enough to buy a house or something like that." and there was, like all lawyers can bring up problems that will probably never exist, but the one that was a key thing that was almost stopped a lot of the negotiation was what happens if this 5-year period expires and Fairchild hasn't exercised its option, and what's going to happen then?
Mm-hmm.
Who owns this?
Oh yeah,
shell of this defunct company. All the stuff that lawyers just love to talk about. But so we were. None of us were looking at this as a way to make a lot of money. I think a few of the wives were not terribly happy about their husbands leaving the security of Shockley for getting into strange
mm-hmm.
business, and which is understandable. Most of them come across the country all at once, and now their husbands are doing some crazy thing. But so that wasn't the key motivation,
right?
And with my background, a lot of money was sort of an incomprehensible thing to me, anyhow.
Mm-hmm. But within a very few years, that you know, the company was expanding quite rapidly.
Yeah.
They exercised their Fairchild Cameron Instrument exercised their option at their earliest opportunity.
Yeah.
Isn't that right?
It was very, very quick, and so all of a sudden I wasn't the owner of it anymore.
Mm.
It was somebody else's company, and that was changed gears.
Are there other beside the, well, in addition to the 8 founders, who are some other early key Fairchild staff that stand out to you as having had particularly important contributions?
Mentioned Dave Allison
yes.
a number of times. There were a number of people that came in without, you couldn't hire anybody that had any training in making transistors, so you just get somebody who was fairly bright.
Mm-hmm.
Bob Robeson was one of them, who was a foreman. He went on eventually to start his own company. Izzy Haas, who I had strong relations with, and then on, was working for Vic Greenwich in device evaluation.
Mm.
Bob Norman came in probably about a year later, but he was the one that was pushing integrated circuits to the outside world.
Mm-hmm.
Long before they were able to make them, he was selling them. And so, I mean, it was growing rapidly. I was hiring lots of people. And we expanded quickly out of that first building and got the garage behind it and the building across the street. And I was spending a lot of my time recruiting. And I realized that it was pretty easy to hire these guys who were very excited about having access to this technology.
Hmm.
And so the problem was convincing their family that moving to California was the thing. So I went dinner after dinner to San Francisco and take to a good restaurant, show them around town, and this went on and on. So they'd get this royal treatment. I remember one guy I hired in the, like he was going to be, you know, running the place or something. And then he came into the plant, and I took him out to this annex and said, "And this is your desk drawer. You're sharing your desk with seven other people." So this point out that Baldwin was right, that we had to really move along on this.
On the new facility, yeah, sure. And where were you living during this time? Were you living, you personally?
I had lived in one apartment after another, and finally ended up in an apartment, sort of a garden apartment sort of thing that I liked a lot. And I, after my schooling, I had a lot of social life to make up for. And so I had a good life. It was a good, pleasant bachelor life that I led there.
Excellent.
And although I would have been, most of my life, as I said, was centered around San Francisco, Peninsula was and still is a pretty much family-oriented,
right,
centered place. And everybody goes to the suburbs at night. And so it wasn't a place for a bachelor.
Were you living in San Francisco then?
No, I lived in the close to the plant.
Right.
And as I said, I stayed at Art Rock's place a lot.
Right. And in addition to what must have been very demanding work life, was the hiking your main sort of hobby outside of work or avocation?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I would do things that just flabbergast me looking back on them now. Mount Rainier is a fairly difficult technical climb.
Mm-hmm.
And I left work on Friday and flew to Seattle and got a car and drove to the base point where you climb the mountain. And Saturday morning, met the guide, and we started climbing Saturday afternoon and climbed up to where there was the last hut by Saturday night, and then got up at 2 in the morning to start climbing, climb through the glaciers before they get messy.
Oh, okay.
When the sun's on them. And I reached the top about noon on Sunday, and then got off the mountain by about 6 o'clock, got back in my car, and drove to Seattle and got on the plane. I was on the plane with all my, I can't believe it now, but I had ice axes, and I saw all my climbing stuff on ice axes and crampons and ropes. I just got on the plane with this ice axe, and I got back to San Francisco maybe 2 in the morning, showed up for work at 8 o'clock. But that was a lot of stamina then. John and I would take huge trips, like over the Thanksgiving or something.
Can you tell me about them?
Well, we went down to northern Mexico a lot, climbed mountains, and all over the Mojave Desert. I've been practically every road on the Mojave that's around at one time or another.
Mm-hmm.
And just exploring and climbing. We took some pretty tough climbs together. That continued into the Imalco days.
Mm-hmm.
I can tell you some more anecdotes about that probably at a more appropriate time.
Okay.
But so we did that. As I said, I climbed. We had one climb with Art Rock and Noyce and Jean and me and probably one other person who climbed the mountain there. I have some nice pictures of that.
Mm.
So that was, but in general, it was just Jean and I climbed. Jean and I.